a lot of people live in denial because they think that to be realistic is to be depressing.
I'm Dr. Mike, host of Going There.
It was the first song where I wrote about how I felt like my depression was killing me and I didn't want it.
Going There breaks the stigma of mental health issues by having real, honest conversations with your favorite musicians, including Alessia Cara, Lizzie Hale, Jewel, Jason Isbell, Gerard Way, Lauren Gray, Shamir, and Barty Strange.
There was something there that was so raw, where I was like, wow, I can't believe someone would say that.
Let's go there on Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network, every other Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Welcome to the Modern Drummer Podcast. I'm Modern Drummer's CEO, publisher, David Frangioni, my co-host, Billy Amendola, and we're here featuring the world's most prolific drummers, listening to what they have to say, and bringing to you from inside the studio, the world of drumming. Billy?
Hello, everyone. Billy Amendola. Tune in to some really interesting facts on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
Welcome, everybody. My co-host, Billy Amendola, and we welcome today, Tico Torres. Welcome, Tico.
Hello. Yes. Hey, Tico. Welcome.
How are you?
Good. How's everybody?
Yeah, good, good.
Good. So Tico's always been a favorite of ours, so I don't think he needs much of an introduction. I mean, we've featured him over since the 80s. So he's well-known, and if the younger generation, that's who we really want. So me and Tico go back a couple of years, and I know we know, you know, each other for a lot of years. So I'm sorry, Tico, if some of this stuff is going to be redundant, but we want to get you in front of the younger generation and your words of wisdom to.
No, that's about everybody. You know that.
Yeah. We want your words of wisdom because this is where it comes from. That, you know, everybody that's here now came because of you, influenced by you. You know, of course, everybody knows from Bon Jovi, he's drumming Bon Jovi since the beginning. I got to ask you a question though, that because I just looked on the Wikipedia, which I'm finding out lately a lot of things are not correct on there. But this is something I never knew. did you audition for Kiss when Peter Criss left in 1980?
No, actually, it was in the same studio they were in, and I was doing a record for T. Roth and Another Pretty Face, a New York-based band. Ace Frehley walked in, and he says, "Chris is leaving the band. Do you want to join?" And offered me some kind of like Mercedes and a bunch of money. And I turned it down. So no, I never really tried to go for it.
Oh yeah, because that's something I never knew that. That was something I didn't even know was out there in the world.
It's not one of those things that you publicize. It came next door into our studio and asked me if I was interested in playing.
But that's a great story. Now, did you turn it down because you didn't want to wear the makeup, or you don't even want to talk about it?
Well, first of all, that's one, because in those days you had to wear makeup and nobody knows who you are. I go, well, shit, I've been doing this 15, 16 years so people know who I am. I said, it's the purpose, you know? And besides, I was just doing a record right there for a band that I liked at the time. So,
yeah, no, okay.
It wasn't my thing.
Now I'm going to go back to this, because I want everybody, this is when I became aware of you. I want everybody to know about this. Except I noticed today when I went looking, you have a cigarette in your mouth.
Well, I got that from Elvin Jones. I learned everything from Elvin.
We're going to talk about that, your jazz. Well, for those who don't know, this is Frankie and the Knockouts. They had a big song called Sweetheart, but Tico joined after that, and he was on this album, which is one of my favorites. And that's when I became aware of Tico, and I became a fan of his. So I've been a fan of his playing since before Bon Jovi. So talking about jazz, because you and David have this in common. I know you were very into jazz, which we've been talking about a lot, how so many rock guys like Hal Blaine and all those guys, you know, got so much work because they were jazz guys and nobody wanted to play rock and roll because they were looked down upon. But I know a lot of people wouldn't realize how much you're into jazz because you're in one of the biggest rock bands in the world. And you and David took lessons off of Joe Morello. Why don't you guys talk about that?
Oh, you studied with Joe?
Yeah, actually, became good friends because he was teaching at Don and Kirshner, right? And he was still on the road with Brubeck, but whenever he was home, he was teaching there. And I walked in there. I said, let me check him out, because I really, really was hanging out a lot with Elvin Jones, you know, and in a lot of ways, he taught me so much. But so I went to see him, and I noticed in his room he had a leak in the ceiling. And of course, I'm an old roofer, you know. I did that for 5 years, so I said, I could fix that for you. And I was 21, 22, and I came there with the truck, the ladder, and fixed the leak. And he says, and we became friends after that forever. And he said, well, anything you want, free. I fixed his room.
That's awesome. And so did you study with him and go through technique of, you know, rebound and all of the things that he really was an expert in?
Not really. I mean, what we did was talk theory and music. Became more friends than a teacher and student thing. Like Elvin, he never tried to, he goes, you can play drums. He goes, I want you to see why I play what I play against McCoy Tyner or Goodman when he's playing the sax. You know, he wanted to explore that with me, and I was more interested in that as well. Not so much the actual chops, you know.
And, you know, that's a good point, because I always felt a lot of times you learn just as much, if not more, as we're saying, when you just speak to somebody who's you're learning from, because you like you said, you already play. So you can listen to their records and study them that way, but to listen to their experiences and to feel like you're experiencing what they experience, or they're giving you tips, sometimes the conversation is just as important in learning.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd sat every time Elvin played in the city, I'd sit next to him at the Vanguard, right next to him, and literally hand him gin and tonics, of course, and cigarettes, and just hawked them for hours and days upon days. It was just the best way to learn, you know, and then have a conversation with him, you know. So it was like, you know, and I went to the Joe, to his brother's studio to actually take lessons. And he heard me play. He goes, you don't need lessons. You need, we talked about music. He said, maybe you need this. And that was very helpful for me. Yeah. The conversation.
And then Tico, you would go back after being inspired by Elvin and sitting there and watching him and taking all that in, you would then go back in and you would play Elvin kind of stuff. Were you into Coltrane and playing like Elvin, at least to learn from there and then build into your approach to rock?
Yeah, I was in jazz bands. We had, you know, upright bass player, keyboard player. I played with Joe Pass. He would sit in a lot. And I was in a band with Willie Bridges. He did a record. I didn't play on a record, but we ended up playing Calls Off the Corner. And he was managed by the Pips. And that's where I met Miles Davis and Ron Carter. Because it was up in Harlem, and I was like the only white dude there. And they would say, you know, you ain't the most technical guy in town, but you got good feel. And I would just play with guys that are 30, 40 years older than me. And that's how you learn. I mean, God, I was a kid, just a sponge. So I was actually in it as deep as you can be. And then, you know, I got into Ornette Coleman. I went to see one of the nicest things about living close to New York or in New York is you can see everybody. You know, you go see Ornette Coleman one day, you can see Frank Zappa the next. You know, I lived in those clubs. For me, I got into the jazz rock drummers like, you know, John Heisman from Coliseum, you know, from Europe. And their rudiment system is different. They attack the ball differently, lefty more than righty. So there's a lot to learn, you know. But the jazz thing, I think, was important for me because of the freedom and the creativity that you could just, it's pure high. It's, you know, you don't need drugs, you don't need anything. That's the stuff that used to get me really off. And then the learning techniques to be able to, now when you apply it to a rock and roll band, you don't have to overplay it. You just have to maybe underplay it sometimes and just add just a little innuendo because you're trying to make the song work. And that helped me a lot.
And how did you become such a great song drummer, as we call them?
Like, I made a decision, I think, a long time ago, not to be a drummer's drummer. And because I would practice my ass off and sit for like everybody else, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours a day. And then that was enough. But I didn't want to go out there and be the drummer's drummer. You know, I want to be the musician. I want to be able to play in bands and make music. So I would listen to whatever the instruments are playing, whether it's the keyboards, who's taking that lead at the time, the singer, the saxophone, the guitar, whatever. And always work with the bass player, and sometimes not play with the bass player, play against them, you know, to just give it another dimension, space. And I thought it was more important to make music and talk with other musicians. I played in Sweden. I got a record in 75, and I realized that they look at jazz and R&B a lot different there. And it took a while to get this bass player, upright bass player, to sweat. After about an hour and a half, he started getting into it. But he changed his demeanor. You know, it wasn't just playing notes. It wasn't being technical. It was about actually feeling it. So I think I did that a long time ago.
Where did Hector is your real name, but where did Tico come from?
My mother called me Ectico. It's little Hector.
Little Hector.
Yeah, Ectico. And then phonetically, I grew up in an Italian-Irish neighborhood. And they call me Tico. So that's stuck, you know, and my son's name, Hector. And around that time, there was a comic called Hector Heathcote, you know, and I used to get, crap from all the kids on that one.
When did it occur that you went from being so into jazz, playing jazz, and that was really the style that you were as a drummer, to rock and then Bon Jovi? Like, what were those steps?
Well, I did them both. I did them both. I was into rock from the beginning. So I grew up learning with the Beatles, like everybody else, like, you know, with Jimi Hendrix, and, you know, finally get to play in a band with Noel Redding years down the line, but all that kind of stuff. I always loved rock. I just thought that some of the rock musicians took it a little further, you know, and you, of course, you could listen to records like King Crimson, and you listen to Yes, and you go, well, these guys did it in their own way. And where they incorporated, you know, jazz rock feel. But I think rock and roll was always in my system. What it did, it just made me a better drummer getting into jazz. And then, you know, I would do gigs, anything that would pay. I mean, I'd do a Wonderbird commercial or play with the Marvelettes or go on a road with them or Lou Christie or Leslie Gore. You know, I worked with them all, you know, because it was just a way to pay bills.
Right. You were a true musician. I mean, you were out there working.
Yeah. And I mean, that's, you know, what it's like.
Yeah. And when you, how did it feel though, when you met John and like, you know, here's this kid and, you know, you're already pretty established. And now here's this kid from New Jersey. Of course, nobody knew what he was going to turn into besides a sex symbol. I mean, obviously he was so good looking. We knew that might've happened, but as far as a musician and becoming the star that he was almost, you had a good 10 years on him, right? So he was like a little, like a kid to you. How did that?
He's got 9 years on him. Yeah. Well, you know, the bass player, Alec, I grew up with him, you know, and I mean, we had a band together when I was 16. And of course, he was older and I always played with guys that were older. And so I knew Alec, and Alec's the one that called me to check this out. It was right down the street. Just got out of Knockouts. Knockouts broke up. Our label folded, and so we just had a pizza and broke up. And I was getting a call from Richie Blackmore, and Ron Anelli was leaving the band and said, look, it's an opening, you want to play? And I just got off the road, and at the same time, I got the call from Alec, and this was literally 10 minutes from where I lived in Perth Amboy. And I went down and checked it out, and I said, you know what? It's not the best singer in the world. It's not the greatest band in the world, but I tell you, this kid's a star, and I just saw his charisma. So I took a chance, you know, and, you know, and it was, you know, we got Richie and we put a band together, and then it kind of made, you know, it started to make sense. And then, you know, worked hard and people knew me in the industry. They would come down from Polygram, Polydor Records and check out the band because I think he had some kind of single deal with Atlantic that he won a contest. And, but he wanted to go and see if we can get other deals. And so Derek Schumann, which is actually a bass player from Gentle Giant, is the guy who signed us.
Wow. Yeah, that hit. And then of course, you know, and that's amazing. Like, I guess your gut feeling was, yeah, let me take a chance on this. And I mean, I love that because that's how things lead to another. I mean, who would have known if you didn't feel like, nah, I'm not going to do that. This is a kid, what's going to happen with this kid? I'm already successful, you know? So that was a, God bless.
Well, it's even bigger than that because you're being tempted by an international rock god, Richie Blackmore, and coming off of Deep Purple and Rainbow, and they were really established. So, I mean, it was really like one extreme or the other. You know, are you going to go with a startup or are you going to go with something more established? And was the first album out or was this before Runaway and like when it really started to happen?
There was no album. There was just a single that he recorded called Runaway. And that was it. That was the basis. He won a contest, AWA.
Yeah, he won a contest on one of the, I think it was WAP or whatever it was here, W-A-P-P. Local station. Yeah. And because he worked at his uncle's studio. Everybody knows that story. And then he did that single and it took off. You're on that. You play on that.
I didn't play on the album.
Did you play on Runaway?
No, I did not. No, okay. Nobody. Who actually, the only guy who played on there was Huey McDonald, bass player.
Oh, okay.
Because that was just a bunch of session guys that his uncle put together.
Who did? Do you know who played drums on that?
No.
I don't even know.
No.
That's a good question. We can put up for Modern Drummer when we run a contest.
and then you guys got the deal, and then the records, and then the whole thing started.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was married. I lived in the house. These guys lived with their parents. So, I mean, I had to work a lot in between to try to pay bills. And it wasn't until the third record hit. So, needless to say, the wife got pissed off and left. And so... I said, okay, sell the house. And I was just basically on the road then. So it took a couple of albums, the third album to actually hit. And it was the help of a Doc McGee manager to book us everywhere. And because we worked everywhere with Japan, we toured with everybody. And then we were touring with 38 Special when the album Slipper When Wet hit number one. And when that did that, we went on our own since then. But it was a gamble. You know, but it took It took three albums for us to find ourselves.
When you made Slippery When Wet, and you're saying the band was finding itself, and, you know, of course it turns out to be this huge hit, but when you made it, did you have a feeling like, wow, we really got something? Because the songs are so good, and you're playing on it is fabulous. You're playing on all the records is fabulous, but you can hear the maturation. You can hear how things are getting tighter and the parts are getting more well sculpted. And it's just really, that record's just a brilliant, brilliant record. Did you feel that way when you guys were in Vancouver and it was coming together?
It was actually very easy to do. You know, a lot of those songs were one or two takes. And when you do a song that's one or two takes, I mean, like Wanted was one take. We couldn't get it. We went out to get dinner and had a couple of drinks, came back at like 11:30, 12 o'clock at night and banged it in one take. But a lot of those songs were one, two takes because the songs were right. They were felt right. And sometimes it's when it comes easy, it's because it's good. You know, a lot of times when you really have to work and work, you're trying to shine something that isn't quite as good, you know, and, you know, everybody goes through that, you know, but this was one of those records that, I mean, we did the rhythm tracks in three and a half days.
The whole record.
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow, great.
That's great.
And you guys were obviously well rehearsed then as well. You knew the tunes and you could just play them down.
That was key. That was key to actually do all the parts and writing and put it all together before you go in there. And we've always done that pretty much because it's just a why waste studio time. And there's certain magics that come out of the studio, of course, but it's nice to have a basis. And, you know, it's also nice. Some bands, you know, they're able to do a record live, do it for several months and then record it, which again could be a beauty to it because now it's just really honed in. Or it could also be overplayed, you know, that's the bad side. But, that, you know, we've never done that, but I think it'd be fun to do that.
What blows me away, Tico, is that your background in playing parallel jazz and rock, and the jazz side, when you think about Elvin and the music of Miles Davis and all these different groups, it's so far out there. You go from here to the moon and back, and everybody is interacting in a, you know, and a lot of musical notes and playing. And then you listen to your playing with Bon Jovi and it's just the perfect playing for rock. It's restrained, but it's perfect, really. It's just what the music needs. And how did you develop the mindset to be able to just be so on in a rock setting when on the other side of the stage playing jazz stuff, it's so different. And a lot of drummers, when they get in the rock setting, there's all these little things that they put in that overplay that style because they're coming from a music. It's just ingrained to be playing off of all the instruments, but you nail it.
Yeah. I think you have to be the song. You have to be that song. You can't say, well, I want to do Living on a Prayer, but I'm going to play more like Keep the Faith. It just doesn't work. or Giant Steps. It just doesn't work. You know, it's like now I'm being a drummer's drummer. Now I'm showing off my chops. So, I mean, sometimes you just put one hit somewhere or a triplet just to build something up and it goes, geez, that just makes a song. You know, and then it's really the producer's job to let that happen. You know, that's key to untie the hands of the musician, which I always thought like Clint Eastwood's very good that way with his actors. You know, he just goes, hey, you act, I'll do the rest. And same thing with music, you play, I'll do the rest. So Bruce Fairman was really a good guy that way. He was a trumpet player, jazz trumpet player, but he knew how to step out of the way and give direction where needed.
And that's where producers are important because you need those, you're too close to it all the time. So you need those extra ears and bounce off different ideas with somebody outside of the band. So that producers are very, very, very important. Who gave you the nickname the Hitman?
Well, I used to be the Heartbeat and Frankie the Knockout. So I guess the Hitman came from, John.
John, right? I think so. I think you said that once before.
Yeah. And then the Frankie the Knockout, Frankie used to call me the Heartbeat.
Frankie, actually, he just friended me on Facebook, actually.
He's a good guy. I love Frankie. He's such a good guy.
Great songwriter, man. I mean, he just had a big charity thing. I think we even ran something for him on online.
He's a hardworking guy, dude. Really is.
Now, when you look back, because I've been, you know, we've all been stuck in the house, and I've been watching MTV, and I'm happy that they went back to MTV Classics, and every Sunday, the whole day is all old videos. And yesterday, a couple of Bon Jovi videos came on from the 80s, and I'm looking at them, and I've seen you so many times. I've sat on the side of the stage watching you. I've sat at Today Show with you, you know, so I'm a big fan of your drummer, but I'm watching these videos and I'm looking and I'm saying to myself, my God, at one time, this was like the biggest thing on the planet. You know, does that feel like another lifetime to you? Or when you look back, do you look back at those videos sometimes? Like, what runs through your head when you look back on those days?
Actually, I just started looking at a couple because I haven't seen them in years. I got to laugh at most of them. It's pretty funny.
You mean when John's flying through the air?
No, I mean, all of us, we were dressed like clowns, but it kind of worked in those days. You know what I mean? It's like, okay. You know, and then, you know, of course, videos and the first Runaway one was like this fire starter thing with the girl's fire coming out her eyes. I mean, you know, it's a $2 video, obviously. And we just got to laugh at those things, you know. But it was a new medium, you know. Again, you know, you could make a video for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 and Michael Jackson goes by, does one for $1 million. All of a sudden, everybody's charging $1 million. And it's like, are you kidding me? You know, of course, it's all recoupable. So, you know, it's we're caught between you're in a hard place there, you know, trying to make that happen.
Well, but, the reality is from a standpoint of when those videos came out and they were top 40 and current, and now you guys are still playing stadiums. A few years ago, Bon Jovi was the biggest act in live music. So, I mean, you're still playing to even bigger crowds. So the momentum's only grown from there. And with your playing, I've had the privilege of seeing you live in all of these different generations. I saw you on the Slippery When Wet tour. You guys did 3 nights at Great Woods at the time. I saw one of those all the way up through a couple tours ago. And your playing is still, I mean, it gets better all the time, but you've always had a discipline where it's perfect for the song. So when I saw you then, and then I saw you 10 years later, and I just saw you a few years ago now, it's just really reliable, perfect playing. And, you know, I mean, I think there's got to be a mindset, an approach to that, to be that consistent. And to just, I mean, it just sounds to me from what you're sharing, your zone is always in the song, which is why every time I hear you play the song, it sounds perfect for the song. You know, that's a discipline, you know, because a lot of guys I see play who have careers that go on as long as yours has with that kind of success. And when you see them on like the fifth time, they're playing all over the place. They're just tired of playing the song. So now the song starts to have all these new drumistic little pieces. So it's interesting to them. But to the audience, they're like, oh, wait, what happened to that fill? And what, you know, why isn't he going to the bell? You know, but when I heard you all those times, it's the same. It's spot on. And to me as a fan, and not take my drummer hat off and put my Bon Jovi fan hat on, it was perfect.
Yeah. I mean, look, I got to see bands and I'd want to hear those certain songs and I want to hear the guitar riff the way it's done because it worked on a record. It just sinks to me. I mean, and same with rhythms and vocal patterns, but it's also nice to see it go somewhere else, you know, but I think you have to be true to the song. And the fans, you know, I mean, look, the reason we're still very popular and be able to do stadiums around the world is because we give our fans what you're used to having, right? And then with just slight embellishments, and then sometimes we'll elongate songs and do stuff live, but then give them new material that we're growing. So they're not, you know, we just released a record in October and it's quite different, you know, but we had to say something about what's going on. We did.
Right. If somebody told you in your younger self that you're going to have a number one country song one day, you would have said, okay, yeah, right.
Yeah, go figure. That's pretty amazing.
You know, I remember one conversation, because I know you're into Latin music a lot and percussion. I know, and we spoke about this, me and you, so many times, and we spoke about oh my God, years ago. Remember you, I asked you if you were going to do any solo records, because I think John was just making his first solo record and he was starting to get into movies, or, you know, and I said, you know, are you going to make a solo record? And you said, we spoke about you wanted to do something with, like, very organically. I don't know if you remember this, with organic percussion, like not real percussion type stuff, but just find things that sounded percussive and make a very like percussion type record. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was my mindset at the time. I mean, I built a lot of stuff, my percussions.
Right, that's right.
I made most of them. And I used a lot of them. And I lost a lot of them. I don't know what happened to half the stuff. It's, you know, when you go to different places and keep them in lockups, you lose things. But I always enjoyed I work with the indigenous tribes. I'm on the board of the Amazon Conservation Team. So I go there and I want to hear their sounds in the jungle, and they want to hear my sounds. And we kind of do that, make sounds on rocks and stuff like this with them. And it's interesting what you can make sound with, you know. I love Latin because I grew up Latin myself, but more with American music, because we never played that much music in my house in New York City. I did have the opportunity to play with Celia Cruz and Cachao and Miami Philharmonic 72-piece orchestra. Did a gig for about an hour and 15 minutes and one rehearsal. It was like unbelievable, you know. And my uncle said, I don't know, Bon Jovi, now you made it. Because, I mean, when you have the Queen of Cuba and the guy who invented the mambo and you're playing with him, you know, it was probably the best Latin gig I've ever done.
Is that recorded anywhere? That's incredible.
Well, as you know, that the Philharmonic doesn't allow recordings. There is no recording of that. No. It's weird. I mean, I flew in, God, it was probably 1998 I did it, but I flew in for one rehearsal with the orchestra. And I came back a month later and just jumped in and did it. And then my drum set was set up front. Cachao was next to me. And right next to me was Celia. So I was right up front. We had five percussionists. And, wow. And another 68-piece orchestra behind it. It was like crazy. I wish there was a recording, but, you know, unfortunately, they don't let you do that, you know, in concert halls.
What a memory, though, and an experience.
Yeah. No, I found a newspaper clipping. That was it.
Dingo, what are you playing for drums and cymbals nowadays? What's your setup?
DW and pasty. You know, I mean, I love the DW drums. I love the sound of them.
You started with Pearl, right?
I started with Pearl. I mean, they gave me an unprecedented contract years ago, and I gave them their first gold record they ever had. So, I mean, so when I walked in, you know, they were together 30 years, whatever, and they never had a gold record in Japan. And we of course, became very huge in Japan. So they treated me very well. And, it got to a point where, you know, all the people you work with retired and they're gone and they're not in your life anymore. So it changed for me. So I needed to go back to the original drum set I had was a DW that I used to have with Frankie and Knockouts, was a DW kit. And, they since perfected the shells were always great, but they perfected the hardware. And that was just, gave my buddy a call and set me up, and they're beautiful sounding drums. They're probably the best things I ever played.
Yeah. And you always played Paiste? That's your cymbal of choice?
Yeah. You know, like everybody before Paiste, Zildjian was, you know, you're talking in the 60s where you'd have to try 20, 30 of them if you had them that many to find one you liked. It wasn't consistent. As a matter of fact, cute story. I was playing in a club band and I was in East Orange. I was packing up, and who was coming in that night was the Buddy Rich band. And Buddy Rich, so I didn't pack up the night before when I finished. I packed up the next day, and Buddy Rich, I hear him downstairs yelling at somebody in the basement. And he came upstairs, and I said, "Hey, how you doing?" And blah, blah, blah. He goes, "Hey, could you use those cymbals?" And my cymbals were all cracked. And he went down and started doing something else, then came back and said, "Look," he gave me a card. He goes, "Go to this Bayonne bus station, ask for Sal, take two cymbals, my gift to you."
Wow.
How about that? So I went to the bus station in Bayonne, and it had these lofts up top, and he kept all this stuff. The guy kept all his kit right there, I guess, for New York. And in that area. And opened up, he goes, you can take two cymbals. They opened up a trap case, took two. It was the nicest thing, you know, and everybody talks so badly to him. I go, that's a great guy, you know. But I guess he felt sorry for me.
that's a great awesome. Story. That's a great memory, too.
What a big heart.
Buddy. Oh, yeah, unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Buddy, yeah, certain people, I always had a good relay. I met him a couple of times and hung out with him a few times, and he was always nice to me. So when people, all that stuff came out later on, I was surprised, you know. I guess, and I was a little kid, so maybe, you know, I didn't see that side of him because I guess he wasn't going to yell at me. I didn't do anything to have him yell at me, but he did go out of his way to be nice to me. So
I met him when I was 15, and he was really, I went back on the bus with him and hung out with him for a bit. Lenny Luzio and Armin Zildjian were there. He was very nice to me. He was a really good guy. I was nobody, just a little kid that was a big fan.
I think he just he got a bad rap. Once, you know what it's like. Once somebody starts with the whole, you know, and then they found those bus tapes and, you know, they turn it into a whole big thing. But that's a great story. That's a great memory, too. Do you have those cymbals? Don't tell me you got rid of them.
Of course I got rid of them. These cymbals are like a hammer, you know what I mean? I don't collect drums. To me, they're tools, you know?
All your kits and cymbals, like just in general, when you're finished, you're finished. On to the next one.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. I got a bunch in storage. I've given some to people and charities mainly, So, yeah. Yeah, they're tools.
Yeah.
You don't have to me the value of like guitars became like this super thing, you know, like $3 million less calls and stuff like that. You know, drums aren't that way. The drums are, it's a car that always runs.
And you always play double bass, right? So your DW kits, double bass, DW snare, two racks.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of simple. Simple kit, you know, two floors.
Now you have a custom kit though, right? Didn't they make 2 years ago or something? They made you a custom, right?
Custom kit. Yeah, 4 years ago. Yeah.
4 years ago.
I got two of them. It's like one's for the studio and rehearsals, and the other one's for on the road.
And did John Douglas do artwork on the latest kit?
He painted them. Yeah, he did a wonderful job. He did a beautiful job painting them because I had a line of baby clothes. And I had these logos and the way it's painted. So I sent them a lot of information that I had, and he kind of emulated that, you know, because we're both artists. So, but I refused to paint my own drum set. So,
yeah, I wanted to bring that up. I wanted to let people know that you're a really good artist and about the Rockstar Baby clothes. What made you do that, the Rockstar Baby clothes?
You ever try to buy kid clothes for kids and they got pink and blue and that's it? I mean, that's not cool. So I said, I guess I got to start a line. So my grandmother is a seamstress. She made all my stage clothes, even in Bon Jovi. All the stuff you wore was handmade by her. I would pick out the materials and stuff until she passed away at 103.
Oh, God bless. God bless.
Like 1993, something like that. So all my clothes were handmade. So I was not that far away. I was an upholsterer too, so I learned how to do all that stuff as well, just to make my own baby line. And I did that for quite a while. I had a store in Lolita, used to be old Def Jam recording studio. I took that over and made that a store, and then I started a line in Europe, which was furniture, carpeting, and I would always give a portion to children, you know. So it was fun clothes, you know.
Yeah, and then artists. I've seen your artwork. I love your artwork.
Yeah, that's my other life, you know. I was, you know, I had my own gallery in Palm Beach for a couple of years. And I painted since I was five. I used to give them out as gifts. And then I got serious and had started showing in Soho. When Soho was actually full of artists, you know, now it's not, you know, has become something else.
Right.
And you're still doing it, of course, right? You're still painting?
Yeah, still doing it. Yeah. But at one point we were off and it was encapsulating my whole life, the art. You know, I had to make a decision whether I wanted to go back into music or just, you know, stay with the art.
Well, before we let you go, of course, I know you guys were supposed to be on tour this year and last year, right? And what's going to, anything, any updates for because I know it's still hard to say because nobody still knows what's going on. But
the only thing we could do now, Billy, is we're looking at 2022. And the only reason is because this thing has to be gone, has to be away, has to be in Europe. You know, they're way behind the United States, Europe. You have to look at Australia, Asia, and Europe differently than America. But everything has to, until the day you can walk into a football stadium or a basketball game and go sit next to everybody and watch it, you're not going to see rock and roll shows from us because it doesn't make sense. You know, right. You can't play for 25 people or 25% audiences, 50% audience. You got to play for everybody. So hopefully we could, you know, by 2022, fall of 2022, maybe we could get it together for that. You know, we're not alone. I mean, every band, I'm sure, wants to do
this. Yeah, no, I know. And it's hard. And nobody can put their finger on it because just when you take two steps forward, it's two steps back. It's like, you know, it's a scary situation. But, yeah. Now, what about new music? Is it going to be?
We just released a new record, so that's enough for now. Yeah. You know, that's it's called Bon Jovi 2020. And we had it done last year, and then we added a couple other songs, and it's really pretty much a socially conscious record. What's, you know, a lot of things that happened in the last 3-4 years. So, you know, it's got some good messages. And so we put that out in October. We did a live version of it in Nashville. And that's it, pretty much. You know, no music. Right now, we're just going to concentrate on, you know, we'll get together and rehearse once in a while. And
beautiful. Well, I want to thank
everybody else.
I know this last year is just, but it's getting better. We're all going to think positive and we're all going to pray. And did you get your shots?
Yeah, I did in January. Good. Yeah, I got the shots in January. Florida has been very good that way.
Yeah. I'm fully vaccinated too. It's great.
Yeah. Down here. Thank God. Everybody. Done. Yeah. Please. Everybody. I know some people are against the shots, but don't take my word for it. Take the scientists' word. Just please, let's get this thing over and done with.
Yeah, the science is pretty good. I kind of like the genetics of the new stuff and how it works. And then hopefully all vaccinations will be that format because it's, to me, it's genius. It's cleaner, better. And, you know, we have to be ready for the next one, you know. But right. If you're ready for it, you know, you could actually do something about it before it gets to a bad point. You know, but yeah, all you do is stay safe and positive.
That's right.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to do this today. You're always relevant. So it's, you know, and you're we all love you at Modern Drummer. Our readers love you, as you know, and you've always
been. Thank you for having me. It's very sweet. I appreciate it. And I'm glad about all the stuff you guys are doing. You know, it's not easy to do what you're doing under these circumstances, but you're getting the word out and that's important.
Yeah. I'll tell you a quick thing. David, because I want people watching the podcast to know, because we have to make it clear. David took over the company completely last February, 3 weeks before the pandemic hit. Hmm. So he has owned and taken Modern Drummer under his wing throughout. We're still in the pandemic. So you could just imagine. So everybody out there, relax. Modern Drummer's not going away. We're going to come. We're already coming back stronger and healthier. And things are going to be, you know, we're going to do our best to keep all our fans happy and our readers. And we appreciate your support. I mean, that's, you know, we're all in this together. So thank you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, guys. It's really wonderful to see you. And thanks for having me.
Really. Yeah. Thank you, Tico. Thank you. Great, great words of wisdom. And very inspired by your playing for many, many years. And it's great to see you doing better than ever and staying strong, especially under all the circumstances. And thank you, everybody, for being supportive of Modern Drummer. So until next time, stay safe, stay healthy.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Tico Torres at Bon Jovi. And I want to congratulate Modern Drummer on a fantastic run. It's one of my favorite magazines because I could always find about some great drummers that are in there, that who's new. Some of the greats that are from the past, their styles, inept, you know, interviews to find out really about the person if you never get a chance to meet them. It's an encyclopedia for drummers. as you know, whenever there's new equipment, you people advertise there, you see what's going on. It's a fantastic magazine. I hope it stays out forever. Can't do it without you, my friends. You're the best.
Those who I lift mine all over you.
Everybody, stay healthy, stay strong, keep drumming, and we'll see you next time on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll see you soon.
At Kroger, no matter where you order free pickup, you get the same great deals as you'd get in-store. So you can save when you order during band practice, or at the dog park, or wherever. Start your cart with the Kroger app and save from wherever today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. $35 order minimum. Restrictions may apply. Subject to availability.
Get more ways to save at the buy five or more, save $1 each sale. Just buy five or more participating items and save $1 each with card. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Spring? Is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. These must-have travel shoes have a lighter-than-air feel and barely-there fit that made them the most packable shoes ever. That means more comfort and less baggage. Try the Superlight Tree Runner with a cushy foam midsole and breathable eucalyptus fiber upper. Plus, they're comfy right out of the box. So what can you do in a Superlight shoe? What can't you do is the better question. And because they're super packable, the real question is, where are you taking them? Experience how Allbirds redefines comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's Allbirds.com. Code SUPER24.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big.